And we welcome you to the Thursday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. It is Kaylin Palomares' visit to the morning show today, and she has engaged a very interesting guest who's going to be joining us to talk about an incredibly important topic. And first of all, Kaylin, welcome back to the morning show. And tell our listeners the topic that you have selected for today and the special expert guest that is joining us as well.
Yeah, hi, Greg. Good morning. So I'm very excited this month because I have brought on Judy Carden. So today we're going to be talking all about bees, specifically our native bees. And Judy is a expert on the topic. So Judy is an educator and a bumblebee expert with the Wisconsin DNR Bumblebee Brigade. That's a citizen science program that the DNR manages. She's also done work with the UW Arboretum, volunteering and mentoring on native bees and native plants. She is she has participated in bee surveys all over the state. I specifically came across Judy because of her work with Rue Pike Wynn and also with her work with Wild Ones, who are two very familiar groups to us here on the radio show. So I really wanted to kind of dive into the bee world, and she's the perfect person for it.
I couldn't agree more. Judy Carden, it's great to make your acquaintance, and we welcome you to the morning show.
Well, I'm very happy to be here. And just a quick correction, it's Carden is the pronunciation.
All right, we will say that correctly. Judy Carden, we welcome you. We're happy to have you. Maybe we could start with a little bit of biography, if you will. Not every last detail about your life, but tell us certainly where you come from originally, and especially tell us about your interest in the natural world, and in particular, your interest in bees, where that comes from or where that originated.
Sure. Well, I'm a lifelong Wisconsin resident. I was born up in the Fox Valley, and I went to school there. And then I moved down to Madison about 25 years ago. And all our lives, my husband and I have been, we've been naturalists. Whenever we travel, we always did nature-based travel. We were bird enthusiasts, insect enthusiasts, just overall ecosystem enthusiasts, where whenever we went somewhere, we just wanted to explore everything that was going on, you know, in the natural world in that area. So we spent many, many hours throughout the country kind of looking at all levels of an ecosystem and began to understand just how important all those different components are and how much they interact. And while we were very passionate about birds, we realized birds wouldn't be there if there weren't insects, and started to see all of those interrelationships that go on. So we got very concerned as climate change started to affect things very dramatically. Pesticides were affecting things very dramatically. Habitat loss was affecting all of the ecosystems and all of the members of the ecosystem very dramatically. And when we got close to retirement, we wanted to do something other than be stressed and frightened and worried and maybe angry about what was going on. We wanted to do something ourselves, whatever small piece of the world it was that we could influence, we wanted to be sure to do that. So we struggled a little bit with what exactly that would be. And I started out, when I retired, I volunteered to work at the Arboretum, because UW Arboretum is just a treasure in the city of Madison, where they have all of these very healthy ecosystems that they support. And I thought, this is where I'm going to go to learn, and this is where I'm going to go to see what my place is in trying to help preserve the natural ecosystems. So one of the first days that I volunteered there, I parked, and there were some flowers by the side of the parking lot, and this huge bumblebee. I'd seen bumblebees all my life, and I hadn't really put together that there were, Wisconsin, there's 21 species of bumblebees. To me, it was, there's a bumblebee. Well, this huge bumblebee flew out of those flowers. She came up about 5 feet from my face, and she flew in this back and forth pattern in front of my eyes, honestly looking me right in the face. And I just thought, well, I think I'm getting a message here. And it truly was an epiphany, because I saw the bee, and I saw the bee behavior, and I thought, there's so much going on in that little bumblebee brain right now, because she was coming out to investigate who I was. She was checking me out. She wasn't threatening me. She was literally getting to know me and trying to understand who and what I was. That was my perception, which I think is actually what was going on as I learned more and more about bumblebees. But I went in to the visitor center, and I realized I was in the perfect place to really understand more about bumblebees, because the UW Arboretum is one of the first places in Wisconsin where the rusty patch bumblebee, an endangered species, was sort of rediscovered back in about 2010. And Susan Carpenter, who is the native plant gardener at the Arboretum, was very instrumental in discovering what was going on with the rusty patch bumblebee, both at the UW Arboretum and in Wisconsin. So I got to know Susan very well, and I learned much about bumblebees from her, and I learned much about native plants and ecosystems from her. And I got involved at that point with the Wisconsin Bumblebee Brigade, which is the citizen science program where anybody in the state can join the Bumblebee Brigade simply by taking a photograph of a bumblebee in Wisconsin and submitting their observation to the Wisconsin Bumblebee Brigade. And that information that is gleaned from those photographs, what flower is that bee using, where is the bee, what is the species of the bee, all helps us to understand what is the current population situation and habitat situation for bumblebees in Wisconsin. Because it turns out that there are over half of the bumblebees in Wisconsin are in a threatened status. So I was in the right place at the right time to, I thought, make a difference for bumblebees in both Wisconsin and the country.
Well, clearly you've done that. Kaylin, it has to just make your heart sing to hear a story about somebody taking this kind of ferocious interest in the natural world. I mean, when I think about some of your education work at Hawthorne Hollow, it folds right into this. I mean, this is exactly the kind of thing you want to see happen.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, I love to hear situations like this where someone has a very personal experience in nature, and that just leads them down this road of passion and of motivation. So I love that so much.
For those of you just joining us, today is Kaylin Palomares' monthly visit to the morning show, and she has engaged a very special guest to join us, Judy Cardine, who is a bumblebee expert, an educator with the Wisconsin DNR, part of the Bumblebee Brigade Citizen Science Program. And as you have just heard, she has for a long time had an intense interest in bumblebees, and particularly those bumblebees that for one reason or another are endangered. Judy Cardine, for a moment, it might be helpful before we explore some of the specifics of the work you do to find out more about kind of the world of bees in general, and in particular, the difference between bumblebees and honeybees. And I think for a lot of us, just kind of walking around through the world, a bee is a bee is a bee, and we don't stop to think about the difference between different categories, let alone being aware of the fact of all these different species that exist, even within the boundaries of Wisconsin itself. Give us an idea of kind of the scope of the world of bees, and then maybe more specifically, the important roles that bumblebees play more so than other kinds of bees.
Sure. Well, first of all, the very important difference between native bees and the honeybee is the honeybee isn't a native bee. The honeybee is an import from Europe, and they were imported basically for agricultural purposes. Right now, what they do is they produce honey, of course, and they're important pollinators in a variety of agricultural crops. The honeybees get transported all across the country in, you know, trucks with hives in them, and they go from crop to crop, pollinating, you know, at the right time, those crops, you know, in various states and locations. Because the honeybee, though, is kept in those, in the hives and in a captive situation, they are very prone to diseases. And, you know, I think we've all heard many times, you know, the bees are all, you know, the bees are dying. How can we save the bees? And a lot of times that is in response to one of these sort of catastrophic captive bee diseases or parasites or, you know, something that's going on because we're trying to keep bees in an unnatural situation. And some of those diseases that the honeybees get actually can transfer to native bees. But I think a very important message for people is that when we talk about saving the bees, what I'm referring to is what can we do to protect native bees? They don't have beekeepers or departments of agriculture that are trying to do everything they can, like the non-native honeybee is the managed bee, to try to protect that resource. What I'm looking at doing is protecting those native bees that do not have beekeepers and protectors to be taking care of them. So in Wisconsin, there are about 500 different species of bees. And most of those are solitary native bees. All these, if you look at a flower sometimes, you'll see all different sizes of little flying things on the flower. So some of those are flower flies, but a lot of those are some of these many different species of native bees. The bumblebee is a social bee, unlike all those other solitary bees. And we have 21 species of bumblebees in Wisconsin. And so the big difference there is that the bumblebee colony has a queen. And how the colony starts is it's an annual colony. The queen has hibernated over winter. She was, last fall, she was a new queen. She was produced in last year's nest late in the summer. She hibernates in, usually in leafy areas. She digs a chamber underground and spends most of her life hibernating 6 to 9 months during the winter months underneath and even the fall months underneath. In early spring, those queens start emerging, and that's when they start building their nest. And what they look for is about over 60% of bees nest underground, of bumblebees nest underground. And what they really like to use is rope poles, because there's ready-made nest material from the old rodent nest in there that they use to support and insulate their nest. So those chipmunk holes around your yard are back really important to leave, because that's the favorite site for a bumblebee to build her nest. But they'll also use, there are above ground nests that get built in, often in rodent nests in vegetation, but in all sorts of vegetative matter. So once the queen finds a place for a nest, she starts building her colony. And she takes care of the first brood of female worker bees all on her own. And about this time of year is when those worker bees reach adulthood in the nest. And then the queens are huge. They're 2 to 3 times as big as the worker bees. But once those workers start flying, then the queen stays in her nest, and we start to see more and more bees because more and more worker bees get produced by the colony. And by about mid-July to mid-August, that's when we're at peak population, and that's your best chance of seeing a bumblebee out on flowers. But the whole purpose of that nest is to produce the reproductive bees, the new queens and the males, so that there's a next generation and that line of bumblebees carries on next year. Because what will happen is the only bees that survive are those new queens, and they survive by hibernating. the rest of the nest passes away, you know, as we get towards towards late summer and fall.
So year after year after year, we see a decimation of bumblebees, but that's part of the natural order of things.
Right. There's two decimations going on. One is very much part of the natural order, and the whole structure of bumblebee life is based on that colony approach to we're all in it to produce these new queens that are going to live over the winter, and the rest of them are going to pass. There's another decimation going on that is very much not part of the natural order, and that is the decimation that's occurring because of the huge habitat loss, climate change, the diseases that can be spread by captive bees, and pesticides.
Right. So the fact that there's already one decimation that is sure to occur, and then if on top of it we lay this man-made decimation, man-created decimation on top of that, it's easy to understand how imperiled the bumblebee is. Before we dig in further, Kaylin, I want to shift over to you. I want to shift back to your previous professional chapter and your life at Hawthorne Hollow. I'm just curious, you and your fellow staff, how much would you encounter bees in a place like Hawthorne Hollow? In general, where did they tend to live, and what would you sort of say was the function that you got to observe?
Yeah, so at Hawthorne Hollow, we had, I would say, you know, many of the different types of bees. So we had solitary bees, we had bumblebees, we had honeybees that we kept there. There's honeybees from hives from neighbors as well. Wasps, hornets, all those, you know, related insects. And they're there because the habitat's there. So we were working day in, day out to create that habitat. There's 90 acres of very, very well, you know, established and kept habitat for not only bees, but for any animals that work in harmony with bees. So again, like birds and other insects. So in that way, we saw a lot of bees. I never got stung. Bumblebees, I've seen that bumblebees don't really sting. I will hold one like a little baby and want to give it a little kiss. Hornets or wasps are maybe another story, but even while I was teaching kids, we never had an issue, because I just think that they just have, they're so content there. There was not as much competition there, nothing really stressing them out. We weren't spraying, you know, chemicals all over them all the time, so I think they were very happy there. But all that being said, we've seen the rusty patch bumblebee there. We've seen, I mean, again, I've seen the most diverse number of bee species there and in that area than anywhere else, other than my own yard and my own garden, but that's a separate story. So
you're well acquainted with this beautiful member of the animal kingdom as well.
Yes.
Judy Cardine, we've not yet talked about the, I guess we've brushed past it briefly, the whole matter of pollination and the fact that one of the reasons it is so important for us to have bumblebees amongst us and in our world, in our habitat, is because of this function of pollination that they do. I think it'd be helpful for us to hear from you just what is going on with that matter of pollination. And is it that bumblebees are especially skilled at this matter of pollination? I mean, is that why the bumblebee especially matters?
The bumblebee has evolved into the perfect pollination machine. Everything about the bumblebee has developed in order to pollinate, because what happens with the bumblebee is they need the pollen, first of all. They use the pollen to feed their young. The pollen provides the protein that's essential for the development of the young. So it is essential for first the bumblebee to be able to collect that pollen. So the bumblebee is covered with little notched hairs that when they walk across the flower, when they dive into a flower to get nectar, they collect pollen in a whole variety of ways, but it all ends up going onto their body. It sticks to those hairs. They've developed little cones in their legs that they groom that pollen off down into the pollen baskets that are on their hind legs. And that's how they carry pollen back to their nest for their young. But they don't get all of the pollen. So as they go from flower to flower, that pollen that they're collecting in order to feed their young is the same pollen that then ends up pollinating flowers and fruit trees and vegetables. And there's a concept called floral fidelity that has also evolved with bumblebees. It is much more energy efficient for a bumblebee to learn how to go into a flower to get nectar and pollen, to learn one flower, than it is to try to learn 30 different flowers. So what will actually happen is that a bumblebee will develop a little trap line and go from the same place to the same place to the same place when they're collecting pollen and nectar. And they will actually go to the same flowers in those places, almost exclusively, not totally exclusively, but almost exclusively. And I've watched bumblebees when they are first approaching a flower and how long it learns to take. It takes for them to learn how to access that flower, because flowers all have different paths. They have different structures. They have different nectar guides that guide a bumblebee into a flower. And once they learn that, and it takes them a minute or two where they're flying around looking and investigating and usually biting just to see what happens when they bite the flower. Once they learn that, then they can zip in and out very, very efficiently. But because they have floral fidelity, well, that's why pollination works, because that means that they're going to the same flowers and they are spreading pollen from the same species of flower to the same species of flower. But they are definitely the most important insect pollinator that there is, just because a butterfly does a little bit of pollination, but they aren't covered with these hairs and they aren't designed to literally collect pollen as they move from flower to flower.
And do I understand also then that bumblebees are especially adept at pollination as opposed to, for instance, honeybees and wasps and others that we think of as adjacent to the bumblebee?
The honeybee also is a social insect that collects pollen. So in some ways they are as efficient, but in other ways they aren't as efficient as the bumblebee. But the bumblebee is by far more efficient than any of the other insects that are collecting pollen. What the bumblebee is most efficient at, when you compare the honeybee to the bumblebee, is what's called bud pollination. And there are many crops and flowers that actually benefit from buzz pollination, in some cases can only be pollinated. So for instance, plants like tomatoes and cranberries and eggplant, peppers, they have hanging flowers and the anthers are hanging down. Well, the way those get pollinated best is when a big, strong bumblebee goes underneath, grabs onto that, and vibrates their wing muscles, and you'll hear a really loud buzzing noise. That's what releases the pollen. And a honeybee is not capable of doing buzz pollination. So I think it's fair to say that the bumblebee is the best pollinator. Mm.
So here in the area, we recently had a community planting event at one of the big parks in Kenosha, and this was an event in which 14,000 square feet of turf grass was being replaced by native plants. And so it was an opportunity for, and several hundred people from the community came to plant native plants. And one of the reasons cited for the importance of this event and this kind of planting was to help safeguard our bees. Explain the difference that is made and why bees need certain plants to be available in order to truly flourish.
First, it just warms my heart to hear that. That is just so wonderful. So what happens happens in an ecosystem is that the members evolve together and they change and develop together so that they can have mutually beneficial relationships. So what has happened with our native bumblebees and our native plants is over thousands and thousands of years, as they have grown up together, they've changed to adapt to each other. So there are many flowers that have specific phenologies. They bloom at the time bumblebees need them to bloom. I'll give one example is the shooting star. And that's a flower that has those dangling anthers, and it requires buzz pollination in order to be pollinated. Only the bumblebee can pollinate that, and there's one other sweat bee that can pollinate it, but that's it. Those two native bees are the only ones that can pollinate the shooting star. The shooting star blooms at exactly the time when the queen most needs that pollen. When she's on her own, she's trying to get pollen to feed the young in her nest. And what you'll get in the Chewaukee Prairie down in southeast Wisconsin has this glorious just swaths of shooting star that bloom right at that time. And if you go in there and you look at what's happening, you will see bumblebee queen after bumblebee queen after bumblebee queen harvesting and pollinating those shooting stars, to the great benefit of their nest, and of course to the great benefit of the reproduction of the shooting star. That's just one example. There are so many flowers that have adapted those mutual relationships with our native bumblebees, and again, to the benefit of both.
So that's probably something that we don't always stop to think about or fully understand, that this is a mutual situation, that the native plants are helping the bees and the bees are helping the native plants. They need one another.
Exactly, that's right. And if you take either one away, the other one suffers. Our native bees, there are a lot of solitary native bees that they're called pollen specialists. And what that means is they only use the pollen from, in some cases, one species of flower to feed their young. So if you have a situation there where that one flower disappears, for instance, there's a spring beauty specialist bee, and the only flower that they can gather pollen for their young from is the spring beauty. If something happens to the population of the spring beauty, that bee is going to go extinct. And vice versa, there's other bees that do pollinate the spring beauty, but a lot of the pollination is occurring by that specialist bee. So it can, if you can have relationships like that with those specialists, where literally the loss of the flower means the absolute loss of the bee. With bumblebees, they're called generalist pollinators because they will pollinate just a very wide species. What ends up hurting them, though, is just where bumblebees were getting a lot of their flowers before man came here was in, there are forest flowers and there are prairie flowers in our area. Both were very important. And of course, when man came in, you know, we needed agricultural land to feed all the people. And the best agricultural land was the prairie land. So all of that fertile prairie land was converted over to agriculture, and all of those flowers were lost. So that's why it is so important for activities like you just described to happen, to be providing those native flowers for the bees, and hopefully, you know, that we can have some growth in the population of those threatened bees.
Kaylin Palomares, you, of course, have seen this firsthand over your years at Hawthorne Hollow, and when you return there and in other special habitats, you've seen this play out, what Judy Cardine is describing.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we just, the planting event that you're referring to was Root Pike Wynn had put that on, and they put in this, like you said, huge pollinator patch at the park. I forget which park it was.
Washington Park.
Washington Park, yeah. And I'd just like to add that, you know, in addition to providing the food source and to supporting that population, I mean, turf grass is one of our most treated with fertilizer crop, really, that we have in our country. So we're putting the most amount of fertilizers and spending the most amount of water and the most amount of maintenance time on our lawns. And in a setting where it's a city park, I mean, you're using resources from taxpayers to mow that and to upkeep that and to take care of the weeds. And so when you convert lawns and you convert just grass into, you know, these prairie type habitats, whether it's all flowers or whether it's a mixture of flowers and grasses, you're not only providing the habitat and the food for insects or for birds or for mammals or any other animal, but you're also providing beauty to the public. And then you're also reducing maintenance costs and helping water quality and soil quality. And there's so many different things that are happening there. So when there's events like this, it's just like, it's multifaceted in its importance on how it's affecting everything. So it's not just to plant pretty flowers, but it's all these different things. It's to provide nesting habitat for the bees. It's to provide food for the bees, for the butterflies, for any, whatever you want to care about, you know. it's all equally important, and it's doing all of those things. So
and just one other thing that's really important about getting rid of turf lawns is, in addition to those fertilizers, when you have turf lawns, when you have non-native plants, you tend to have a shelf full of pesticides in your garage, because you're trying to support basically plants that don't belong here. They haven't grown and evolved. They don't have those mutual relationships with insects. And bad things are constantly happening that people want to fix by either using insecticides or using herbicides or using fungicides, or using rodenticides. Every one of those sides, and they're all part of that pesticide family, they are designed to kill. That's what a pesticide is. And whether it outright kills a bee, and many of them just outright kill them, but even if they don't, like a fungicide, doesn't typically cause instant mortality, but it still causes problems for insects and specifically for bees. And what studies have found is that fungicides really interfere with the bees' ability to orient. And so what happened, they've done studies where bees that have been exposed to fungicides don't come back when they go out to forage, or they take twice as long to return when they go out to forage because of the effect that toxic chemical has had on the bee's brain and development. So another really important aspect of native plants is that, we have almost a completely native yard ourselves at this point, and we have not used a pesticide in 10 years in our yard, and we have zero problems. Because in a balanced ecosystem, you really do have, there'll be insects will take care of those insects that are chewing on your plants. But having insects chewing on your plants is a good thing. It means you've got butterfly caterpillars there. You know, it's a healthy ecosystem where there's holes in the leaves, and things stay in balance. You know, if you have a native native plants and native insects in your ecosystem.
For those of you just joining us, we're enjoying a monthly visit from Kaylin Palomares, and the very special guest she has engaged for today's program is Judy Cardine, a bumblebee expert and educator with the Wisconsin DNR. Judy Cardine, I know that you have engaged repeatedly in bumblebee surveys all around the state. Explain what happens in these surveys and the important function that they serve.
Sure. So first, a little bit about the rusty patch bumblebee, which is a federally endangered species. And they got that designation because they've lost about 90% of their population across the country. They used to be a very common bee throughout the northeastern United States. And they are now have a very small area, and Wisconsin is sort of at the heart of the area where there are still populations. So that's one of the reasons those surveys are very important. So we've conducted surveys for the USGS, the federal kind of scientific arm that does scientific surveys. And what we're looking for is where do rusty patches, where do they still have populations? And then what we're also looking at in those surveys is where we know there are populations, what's happening to those populations from year to year. You know, are they going down? Are they going up? You know, what's happening? Are they in worse trouble now, or are they maybe doing a little bit better? So what happens when you do a survey is you can do one specifically for a species, like we've done many that are looking for that endangered rusty patch bumblebee. But you also do surveys to look overall at all of the bumblebees. You know, any species of bumblebee that you see, you record, and in our case, we're sending it into the Bumblebee Brigade program. And when you do a survey, if you're doing a scientific survey, then you've got this very specific, here's the pattern that you walk, here's the amount of time you take, here's the information that you record. You know, so those are kind of research-based studies, and you really kind of have a program to follow. But another type of survey that gets done, which everybody can participate in, is through the Bumblebee Brigade. And that is so simple. That is when you go out in your yard, when you go to a park, when you go to a nature area, when you go for a walk, have your cell phone with you and take photos of bumblebees. And then what happens is you're gonna record where those are based on the location you're at. And submit them to Bumblebee Brigade. So at that point, we know what you saw. We know what bumblebees were in the area you were there, you know, where you were that day, and what flowers they were using. And that also gets used for a lot of scientific research and also for land management in our state.
I think our listeners have some acquaintance with the rusty patch bumblebee by now. And I know at least here in southeastern Wisconsin, and I think Kaylin will be able to speak to this, we've seen at least a glimmer of hope that there have been some promising signs of at least a bit of a rebound. How about the state overall? How is the rusty patch doing, and are these efforts to help it making a difference?
There was a study done recently that looked at the genetics of those populations of rusty patch bumblebees that are still here. And sort of the frightening aspect of that study was that it showed that the gene pool is very, very reduced. And what it also highlighted was the critical importance of every one of those rusty patch new queens, because they each represent a new colony. So while we definitely see rusty patch bumblebees in Wisconsin, and it's mainly the southern, about half of Wisconsin, we do have a few sightings up in northern Wisconsin, but the main population is in the southern part of the state, that when those populations were studied, it's not a rebound in the sense of everything's great, we've pulled out of this down here and the rusty patch bumblebee is safe. What those studies showed is that we don't have enough diversity yet in the number of bees to feel confident that we actually have had a rebound. What we will see is from year to year, depending upon environmental conditions, we can have some ups and downs in the populations, but we aren't actually seeing a overall increase that would in any way say, hey, they're safe here. We're still in a situation where it is critical for each of us to take the kind of actions that we've been talking about, because what the rusty patch bumblebee needs, what all bees need, but what is critical to the rusty patch bumblebee is they have to have that habitat that supports them. They have to have flowers from April through October. In April, when those rusty patch queens come out of hibernation, they have to have nectar available right then. The reason they're coming out of hibernation in April is they have depleted all of their body fat stores from hibernating for 6 to 9 months. And if they can't get right at food at that point, that queen isn't going to survive. If she doesn't survive, that represents an entire colony of rusty patch bumblebees that doesn't occur, and an entire new group of new queens that never happen. Throughout the summer, that you really need good bumblebee flowers available for all those workers to be able to forage and pollinate and bring that pollen back to the nest. Because again, the whole goal of that nest is raising those new queens. When we get to the fall, the late summer and fall, that's when the new queens are emerging from the nest. They have to be able to feed enough to build up those body fat stores so that they can survive hibernation. And if they don't have the flowers available for the season, then they're not going to survive. So that means we need to plant those asters and goldenrods and those late blooming flowers. And it's important both to do the great projects like you just described, where a large area gets replanted and turf grass gets replaced. It's also important for homeowners, for each of us, to look at our own yards and say, what can we do in our yard? Not everyone might be willing to do what we did and turn their entire yard into, you know, a native plant garden, but take a corner, take a section, you know, maybe every year add to it. Because if all of the yards in your neighborhood all do something and create those flowers that are going to last the whole season, that's going to create this pollinator corridor for all of those rusty patch bumblebees to be able to find the food they need. The other thing they really need is they have to have hibernation and nest habitat. And that means, in addition, in our yards, leave some natural areas. Leave the leaves, leave the stems, leave the rodent holes. Let at least part of your yard look like it would look, you know, if it wasn't in a yard and we weren't trying to manicure it in any way, because that's what the rusty patch bumblebee needs for survival. And then finally, no pesticides. Yards do not need pesticides, especially if you have native plants in your yards, and every pesticide is going to cause harm to the rusty patch bumblebee.
Important words of caution and advice for anybody listening who cares about this really important issue. And Judy Cardine, briefly, if anybody wants to be a part of the Bumblebee Brigade under the auspices of the Wisconsin DNR, what do they do?
Very simple. You can just go online, just Google Wisconsin Bumblebee Brigade. It will take you to the Wisconsin Bumblebee Brigade website. It'll walk you through, you know, say there's a little get involved tab, click the get involved tab. There's training there. There's how you can submit your photos. And it's as easy as submitting a photo to become part of the Bumblebee Brigade.
Kaylin.
Yeah, I just want to add that so I've been in my own yard. I've been working on a native garden since about 2020. It was my COVID project that started. And over time, like you said, I've just started adding a little bit more every year. I just keep getting pulled into the Wild Ones sale and buy more and more every year. And then I collect seed and reseed it where I want it. So now at this point, I have native garden patches in my front yard, my side yard, and two in my backyard. And through that time, so last summer, every evening, before it gets dark, I do a little walk around of my yard, and I just go and see. I take pictures of the pretty flowers, and I see what's blooming today, and I see if there's any, you know, birds or insects that are using my plants. And every day there's something, and that's a really exciting part about it. But last summer, I was walking my yard, and I was seeing some bees on some of my flowers, and I was trying to take some pictures, and I was getting closer, and I saw a little brown band on one of the bees, and I taking pictures. And after really looking at the bee in person and looking at it on my phone, I'm like, this is a rusty patch bumblebee in my yard. I live right next to a main highway. I live in the middle of a neighborhood. Most people in my neighborhood don't even have much for landscaping to begin with. If they do, there's annual flowers in baskets, things like that. And so I was about to start crying over it because it was so exciting. And I'm thinking, oh my gosh, is there a nest somewhere? You know, what else can I find? And so I went online and I put it on iNaturalist, which is another kind of citizen science app that people can use, where you can put in any type of observation, whether it's bees, butterflies, mammals, plants, anything. And I also submitted it to the Bumblebee Brigade too. And I heard back from the Bumblebee Brigade thanking me for submitting it and confirming that it was a rusty patch bumblebee. So it was very easy, and it's a very fulfilling, exciting thing, especially when you do care about these things, because it's proof that what you're doing is actually providing the habitat. It's making a difference. Mm. So that was good. And it was on mountain mint is what it was foraging for. Mm. So
yes. if people want to find out a little bit more about bumblebees, we also have the Wisconsin Bumblebee Observers Facebook page that I'm the administrator of, and the whole goal of that is to help people understand about habitat and flowers and what they can do in their yards to make a difference. And every one of us can make a difference in our yard for bumblebees.
Well said. Judy Cardine, thank you so much for being our very special guest today on the morning show. It was wonderful to meet you, wonderful to have you be part of this, and very best wishes to you.
Thanks. It was a pleasure.
All right, and to finish out, Kaylin, I know you have a couple of announcements you want to share with our listeners.
I do. So it is a busy weekend here in the Kenosha area, so I first wanted to highlight that the Kenosha County Park System, they do a kind of concert series. Rhythm on the Lake takes place at Old Settlers Park in Paddock Lake on Thursday. So tonight, 6 to 8 p.m., and that's a free concert. The band is called Relatively Close. That looks like it's going to be a lot of fun, and they have those on certain Thursday nights throughout the summer. So keep an eye out for those if you want to go to any others. Another one is on Friday tomorrow, June 13th, from 6 to 9 p.m. is the Pike River Benefit Concert Series kicking off at Hawthorne Hollow, obviously. That is $15 at the door. That supports the efforts at Hawthorne Hollow. And that band is Peace Tree All-Stars that's going to be playing tomorrow night. And then finally, just kind of a fun thing that I found, Warner Botanical Gardens up in Hales Corners in Milwaukee area, they do a free day once a month throughout the summer. So on Thursday, June 26th, they're open from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. You can go up there and it's free entry. And they do that every last Thursday of the month, May through October. So if you're looking to get out and kind of see something new and see some beautiful natural areas, that's a great place to go. So I wanted to share that one.
Great idea. Kaylin Palomares, thank you so much for today's program. And we look forward to seeing you again very soon.
Greg.
And it's 8:59. Tomorrow on the morning show, a conversation about AI, artificial intelligence, and how it is playing out in the lives of young people, especially the lives of young people dealing with trauma. Tomorrow on the morning show. Today, partly sunny skies, a slight chance of showers developing this afternoon, a high of 72 degrees, a better chance of rain tomorrow into Saturday and Sunday. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva.